I weigh him and my car will reach out.
The music of Via Farca Touré and beautiful music we'll be listening to in and out of our breaks coming, well, out coming into our breaks, not out, coming into our breaks. Only out is just us talking. In is when you'll hear the music. Okay. Via has three performances in our region, one in Northampton, one in Woodstock, one in Saratoga Springs, and very, very cool. The Northampton is on the 22nd. That is, for those of you keeping score, is tonight. And then tomorrow is at the Bearsville Theater in Woodstock. And on Saturday at UPH in Saratoga. Via Farca Touré. Was that my... Oh. My watch just found the Bearsville site. Okay. Thank you very much, Siri. Being corrected in real time.
Thanks, Siri.
Yes, thank you. All right. So you can find out more by going to wmc.org/roundtable, and there you go for that information. Good morning, all. Welcome. Happy Wednesday to you. We have a Tuesday to you. Happy Tuesday to you. Oh, it's one of those days. I'm on a lot of cold medicine, so it's not going to be good. I'm just telling you right now. The you know how color-coded cold medicine is?
You really are on cold medicine.
So I figured out that the daytime is like the orange or yellow pills, right? And then the nighttime stuff is either green or blue or purple. And God forbid you get those mixed up.
That's like the old Seinfeld bit with him and George there saying, do we want fast acting or long lasting?
Well, that's right.
How do you decide?
It's absolutely true. So now, you set this up perfectly for me, JP, because then, I've taken this now liquid. It's Supermax. Now, the Supermax pills is 600 milligrams. The Supermax liquid is 1,200 milligrams. Oh, Mike, well, that is what I would think. They both, like, one would be more max than the other, right? So I got up in the middle of the night. I'm coughing my fool head off, and I can't sleep. It's like 2 in the morning. So, you know, I take another dose of the liquid. So now am I still high from that? I don't know. I really don't, but I feel it. I feel like I may be. So thank you for your patience. I appreciate it, and it's good to have you here with us. We have a lot to talk about. We have a wonderful group to do it. Let me introduce them to you on this Tuesday morning. Mike has my cue card. It's Tuesday morning, and we welcome you to the program. Panel at WAMC.org if you would like to join us. We welcome our dear friend Emily Honan, a grants analyst based in Albany. Good morning, Emily. How are you?
I'm doing.
All right. It's good to have you here.
Thank you.
You know, we had your father on last week.
I heard.
He's very proud of you, and very excited that you're on. And we had a lot of nice things said about him, but mostly about that he brought you into the world.
Yes. Thank you. You know, it's nothing.
That's a nice compliment.
Yeah, that was
a very nice compliment.
Yeah. Tear rich. We think you're nuts. However, we love your daughter.
That's a big deal.
He'll take it.
Yeah, that's good. We like it. And then we welcome J.P. Miller to the program from the Empire Report. Good morning, J.P. How are you?
Good morning. I'm great. And from my standpoint, you look and sound great.
Oh,
and
thank
I can't
you.
Tell anything on the cold
yeah.
medicine.
Well, just you wait. Just you wait. And then we welcome former Times Union Associate Editor Mike Spain to the program. Hello, Michael. How are you?
I'm great. I'm happy to be here, and I'm sure you'll have a speedy recovery.
Yeah, don't make me laugh, because then I just can't
that.
Stop. No, I'm sorry. All right. Well, we have a lot to talk about, and I think that, of course, I want to talk about the Pope, and we'll do that in a few moments. I would like to start on the Pete Hegseth story because I do think it's interesting, and it's one that I believe is going to go on. I want to get a journalistic perspective from this in a moment because I find this to be fascinating as well. So, for those of you unaware, Pete Hegseth is once again in some turbulence. As there was the Signal conversation that happened in March and a controversy that took place that the Secretary of Defense was part of the Signal conversation that went to, of all people, a journalist who got added into the group chat on Signal. Well, then we learned over the weekend through reporting from the New York Times that he also then, using his private phone, shared the same information on the Signal app with people like his brother and his wife. And
isn't she a Fox News producer?
Was, okay. Yes. Yeah. And then brother is the lawyer, and then they all sort of have some the two relatives, I believe, have some State Department or Pentagon roles. But the sum and substance of this is no reason whatsoever to have this sensitive information. Now, I don't call it classified because there seems to be controversy over calling it classified information, although by all appearance it would be classified information of telling where and when bombs were going to fall. All right. So then this information came out that there was this, what they're calling Signal 2.0. President Trump on Monday dismissed a deepening controversy surrounding Pete Hegseth, declaring the embattled defense secretary is doing a great job, despite seismic dysfunction within the Pentagon amid political infighting, numerous firings, and reports that he divulged to his wife, brother, and lawyer the highly sensitive details of an imminent military operation. The turmoil elicited a rebuke from at least one Republican lawmaker who labeled the situation a meltdown and called into question how long Trump's affection for the increasingly isolated and defiant cabinet pick will last. Pentagon officials have watched the unraveling of Hegseth's inner circle with alarm, concerned how it would function in a national security emergency, and wondering whether the president may be forced to act. So Hegseth came out yesterday at the Easter egg roll and said, "Look, you know, these are disgruntled employees." He didn't deny the fact that he made the case, by the way, or that he made the call. But he said that these were disgruntled employees who were going to use anything else in a scorched earth to get him because they were fired. Now, the question is why they were fired. And then that comes that they apparently leaked information, which I can only assume was the information that let us know that indeed there was a second Signal call. I do not know that. I think the logical assumption of many who are looking at this case. Now, meanwhile, I just want to, and this is where the journalistic part of this comes in, which I find to be a little interesting, because the regular narrative is that the president is standing firm and is standing behind the Secretary of Defense, and by no means has any plans at the moment to dismiss Secretary of Defense Pete Hegseth. However, in at least five articles that I read last night, this term was used: the president will support you until he doesn't.
Yeah. Well, that is consistent with other times when Trump in his first administration and afterwards, someone would leave, it would be he would support them right up till days before, even hours before. And then when they left, it would be, you know, there'd be some window dressing excuse like, I'm leaving because it's in chaos, and I don't want it to interfere with President Trump's effort to move forward, or, you know, some quote.
I don't
like
want
that.
To become a distraction.
Right.
Spend more time with the family, all that kind of stuff.
Pursue other interests.
That's right. So then, which I find interesting, is Tom Bowman of NPR News yesterday put out a story with an exclusive that said the White House is looking to replace Pete Hegseth as defense secretary. And I have not seen a version of this story in any other news source, but I find it interesting that according to NPR sourcing, and at least one, if not two, representatives, they say that the White House is actively looking to replace Pete Hegseth. So that is interesting in and of itself. The question we had in our journalism class yesterday at Bennington that I was teaching is, okay, so one of these stories is wrong. let us watch and see.
But one can affect the other all the time. This happens. If they were actively searching to replace Hegseth, and then it is reported, and Trump insists that he's supporting him fully. He's doing a great job. It makes it more difficult for Trump to, not take the advice of his close advisors that might be telling him it's time for Hegseth to go. Trump likes chaos when it's something that he deliberately causes. He doesn't like chaos when it's somewhere else. He doesn't like it when someone else is getting all the attention and it's negative. It doesn't help him at all. If he's causing chaos, it's part of his modus operandi. So maybe at one point, even after standing behind him yesterday at the egg roll, he might convince Hegseth that he has to go. But I mean that what you said exactly, Joe. He's supporting him until he doesn't.
This is what the media does. They take anonymous sources from disgruntled former employees, and then they try to slash and burn people, ruin their reputation, and it's not going to work with me, he said defiantly yesterday during the Easter egg roll.
You can only be so hard during an Easter egg roll. he's like,
you can be so defiant.
They will not take me alive.
Now let's get back and put the spoon, put the egg in the spoon and run across the lawn. JP.
Yeah, I agree with Mike in that I think that the president was probably having a good time yesterday at the Easter egg roll and they wanted to, show his softer side. And what the news story was certainly Hegseth's video there. And it is preposterous to listen to someone go so hard at the media at an Easter egg roll. It's going to be a Saturday Night Live skit on Saturday night. And I also agree with Mike in that when Trump creates a scandal or creates a controversy or creates chaos, he sees it as his own kind of brilliance that he is, that he is creating this. And when it is someone else, it's rare that he likes it. I think that those stories could have, those stories could both have some truth in them, in that they may be looking for his replacement while not yet fully deciding that he's on his way out yet. But as we've seen over the years with Trump White Houses, being that cabinet secretary that everybody thinks is the next person in line to go, from my perspective, is it's usually that means that you're the next person to go. It's not a good place to have a huge distraction, obviously, which is at the Defense Department. Hegseth is committing unforced errors. And not only that, is I would imagine that the president sees Hegseth on TV battling those reporters, and he's not even doing a good job at it.
I was going to say, I mean, maybe he meant he was doing a good job at the egg roll, yeah. I think that's what he's going to argue later when those words try to come back on him. I feel like it's finally getting to the point. You mentioned that he was the defense secretary. I think it's finally getting to the point where the people who are in, who know what they're doing, are starting to get so annoyed that someone so incompetent is, in this role, messing up something they've worked their whole lives to do. That maybe it can overcome, sort of the Trump cult. But, you know, that is wishful thinking. And I also do think that both statements are true. They were probably both true at different statements, at different places in time.
New Hampshire Senator Jean Shaheen, a Democrat on the Armed Services Committee, said in a statement that Hegseth should accept responsibility. Quote, but we must not forget that ultimate responsibility here lies with President Trump for selecting a former weekend TV host without any experience successfully leading a large and complex organization to run our government's biggest department and make life and death decisions for our military and country. And I've heard many on the left also take this a step further and say that that Senate Republicans also had a huge role in this, in allowing somebody who did not have the experience, was very green in regard to running a defense department, but one by one vote that ultimately went to the vice president of the United States.
Yeah, it's hard for the Republicans in Congress, in the Senate, to step away from the fact that they did approve Hegseth after all the revelations about his alleged drinking, his managing of a veterans organization, and which was reported to be terrible, and alleged assaults on a woman during some kind of event for the veterans organization. I mean, after all that stuff came out, and his lack of real administrative experience and his history of attacking the Pentagon leadership, why did enough of them vote? Why didn't more of them stand up and say, maybe this isn't the right guy?
I'm sure they tried. No.
Remember
I'm not
the letter
even
from his own mother?
Credit.
You sure? Really? What?
Remember the letter from his own mother?
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's bad. A letter from your own mom saying
that
you're a...
Oh, yeah. I mean, she has since said that was made in
it was
in
on
anger.
The record. It was on the record from your mom.
Yes. And she said that they can do better. Ultimately. So.
And by the way, what was the Secretary of Defense even doing at an Easter egg roll? I understand the president, it's the White House, it's a ceremonial thing, it's a tradition, but why?
He was having fun.
But I mean, he should go to like ceremonies honoring veterans and honoring soldiers and doing, I mean, if he's going to do ceremonial things, it just seems so silly.
Defend the bunny.
Right. That's true. And his assertion that these are anonymous allegations made against him, it's his own appointed spokesperson who wrote a column under his own name.
And we'll talk about that in a moment of sort of the unraveling of those closest to Pete Hegseth. We'll take a break. We'll be right back after this. Good morning. Welcome to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. We are talking about the Secretary of Defense, Pete Hegseth, and the questions that come after another. I don't want to use the word bombshell, but another
revelation.
Revelation. Thank you very much, Mike. A revelation that came forward reported from the New York Times on Sunday regarding the signal chat that took place in March, in which the bombing of Houthi rebels was shared with those in the highest places of within the State Department's and the State Department and defense officials at the Pentagon, and with a journalist at Atlantic Magazine. That in and of itself a problem and a controversy in its own right. Then comes the second story, which is that also information apparently on his private phone, the Secretary of Defense's private phone, Pete Hegseth, to his wife, to his brother, to his lawyer, and telling them exactly, pretty much verbatim, what he was saying on the other group chat. So I assume there was a fair amount of copy and paste in that regard. So what the one part of this story that I find fascinating, we touched on it, but I would just like to go back to it a little bit, is that all of this broke on Sunday. However, on Saturday and Friday actually is when it was announced, that Hegseth's team, those closest to him, were all fired. So three fired political appointees then on Saturday accused Hegseth of slander. They said that they had not been told what exactly they were being investigated for, if there was an active investigation or if there was even a real investigation of leaks to begin with. They were told that they were going to have a polygraph test. They never received a polygraph test prior to their firings. Those fired were Dan Caldwell, Colin Carroll, and Darren Selznick, apparently for making unauthorized disclosures to the news media. Now, what is also interesting, I think, in this particular case is that these three individuals have had ties to Pete Hegseth for a very long time. They were not, while newly hired, because everyone in the administration, because it's new, were newly hired, but they were all with him for a very long time, and up until Saturday, his closest confidants. Now, then you have other people within the department who are complaining quite loudly, including the op-ed in Politico on Sunday, saying this guy has got to go because there has never in the history of the Pentagon and the Defense Department has there been so much chaos, and this is now becoming a national security nightmare, was the term apparently used. So Caldwell said in an interview with conservative journalist Tucker Carlson, to which I replied, he still has a show?
I thought that too.
I didn't know that. But I guess I don't know.
He's got a podcast, yeah. I think.
Okay. Yeah. All right. So good for him. So Caldwell said in an interview that aired Monday evening that he had not leaked information to the media and has not been provided with a reason for his firing. Despite the allegations against him, he said he has not received a polygraph test or been asked to provide his phone to authorities to be examined for potential leaks. Caldwell added that he believes the leaks investigation was weaponized against him, Selznick, and Carroll. He said that when he was first escorted out of his office, he thought he was about to be asked to testify against Hegseth in an ongoing Inspector General investigation about his use of Signal. He had access to highly classified information until right before he was removed. If I actually did some of the things that anonymous people on the internet and people in the Pentagon said I did, I'd be in handcuffs. Hegseth's team also intends to remove his chief of staff, Joe Casper, and shift him to a less visible but as yet undetermined Defense Department role. People, doorman, people familiar with the matter said. That development, first reported by Politico, followed weeks of friction between Casper and other colleagues who were fighting over how bad Hegseth was and how bad the department was and how bad things were going because there was such chaos and tumult. Defense officials have declined to acknowledge Casper's impending move or address questions about who is fulfilling the duties of the Defense Secretary's Chief of Staff. Sean Parnell, a spokesman for Hegseth, did not respond to requests for comment. So I just wanted to differentiate. There is the whole question as to whether Hegseth is going to stay or is Hegseth going to go or how is the president going to support Hegseth or not support Hegseth. But then there's this whole other issue of, well, what is happening at the Department of Defense and the Pentagon, which seems to be in total disarray if we are to believe all of the people who are in top leadership or were in top leadership positions up until Saturday and what they're saying.
I think the whole thing is just like this insane lack of foresight. First from Trump on appointing this guy who had no experience whatsoever, and the only experience we did know was bad. Then on the Republicans for allowing him to be appointed. Then, you know, on Hegseth's own part, like, I'm not really sure what's going on down there, but was the solution here to remove what he thought was the problem, to remove people that might have turned against him, to remove people that maybe they also had private Signal stuff on their phone? Did he not think that they would then perhaps, you know, have some dirt on him and then go to the media? I mean, like, what was the thinking there? What, you're only making yourself look worse. You fired everyone in your inner circle. I mean, I just don't understand what the reasoning is.
In a day filled with really great quotes, my personal favorite comes from Carolyn Leavitt, who is not a font of favorite quotes. But she said, a spokeswoman for Donald Trump, of course, portrayed Hegseth as the victim of an expansive opposition within the department, alleging that, quote, the entire Pentagon is working to undermine him. Is that a defense?
That's an indictment, actually, I think.
Yeah.
You know what it does is it shifts all the focus away from Hegseth and to that quote where we say, what do you mean? So, you know, she's doing her job.
The entire Pentagon is working to undermine him. The question being, oh, well, why are they doing that? Are they actually looking for stability and trying to do their job? Or are they embarrassed by what is being revealed?
Yeah. Whatever the reason is, I mean, it could be any part of that. It seems to be describing a situation where the White House is at war with the Pentagon. Politically speaking, and they are trying to disrupt it. And in that regard, perhaps Hegseth is doing exactly what the president wants. He wants to break down all the traditional institutional barriers that are there, and sort of take control and assert their, you know, much like what's going on in a lot of other major departments like that DOGE is doing. You know, it puts Trump in an awfully difficult position now, because having stood behind him, for him to now push out Hegseth will really undermine what Trump has been doing so far, and that's standing firmly behind him.
And what I was hearing, too, is in a lot of the commentary is that then putting other cabinet secretaries who also have had their share of issues also questioning, you don't want it all to be lumped in that these people are unqualified for their jobs, whether they are or not.
I think you may be reading into it too much, which is, it was, we've seen with him, once he's done with someone and he thinks that they are
a liability,
not helpful to him, a liability rather than an asset, he's going to get rid of him very quickly once he comes to that conclusion, and he will not consider the consequences of, oh, it's going to affect other people, or he's been standing by him. He stood by, you know, 100 different people that he ended up firing, and he doesn't think twice about it.
You're absolutely right. I mean, that's a really great point. And I think the differentiation that people were trying to make was that this was a different administration, in the sense of that there was a new ethos that was taking place within Trump 2.0 as opposed to Trump 1.0. Whether that's the case or not, I don't know. I don't know how you, as Alan Chartok used to say on this program all the time, you know, you can't change character.
Right.
So,
well, right, that's true.
It's character. And also, being in the White House is a pressure cooker, and it's a very challenging job, even for the most capable and qualified people who would be capable and qualified to do that. And Hegseth, as you started out with, Joe, you know, he was a weekend news anchor. He wasn't a news anchor. He was a weekend news anchor. And that's I don't mean to disrespect weekend news anchors, but he didn't quite get to being a news anchor. And it is a tough. It's the toughest job imaginable, working in the White House every day and navigating what's really, you know, a challenging environment. And Hegseth is clearly not up to it. And I think Trump will get rid of him sooner rather than later.
So then, and this is the final point, we'll take a break right after this, but I just was also fascinated by this. So now there's a plan while Rome is burning, there's a plan within the Hegseth orbit of how to get back on track and to correct all of this. So to reinforce his inner circle of political aides, this according to the Washington Post, Hegseth plans to make Marine Corps Colonel Ricky Buria, most recently his junior military assistant, a senior advisor and possibly even chief of staff or deputy chief of staff, according to people familiar with the matter. Defense officials said Buria unexpectedly submitted paperwork last week to leave the Marine Corps and is now considered on terminal leave, transitioning out of the service. Buria was promoted to his current rank last fall, meaning that without a waiver, he will revert back to his previous rank, lieutenant colonel, in retirement. With few exceptions, a service member must hold a rank satisfactorily for 2 years to retire at that pay grade and receive benefits commensurate with it. But the real point of the story is the third paragraph. The person familiar with Trump's thinking questioned whether Beria is suited for such a job, noting that he first served as a junior military aide to Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin in the Biden administration. While it is common for military officers to hold nonpartisan roles that bridge presidential administrations, it is unclear whether this White House will accept Beria. Also, I think, fascinating.
I think that, are you going to go to a break first?
No, go ahead.
I think that nonpartisan is an interesting way to describe that, because I think Trump really, the military can be nonpartisan in a lot of ways. And I think that Trump does not like that. The military is willing to say, we can't do that. It will be a national security issue. And Trump will say, but I want to do that.
The other point I wanted to make before we go to break real quick is that Representative Don Bacon, a representative of Nebraska, a retired Air Force general, said that the military should always pride itself on maintaining operational security, and that it is unacceptable if the new reports about Hegseth's handling of sensitive information are true. And this is the line that I liked from Representative Bacon. If a Democrat did this, we'd be demanding a scalp. I don't like hypocrisy. We should be Americans first when it comes to national security. We'll take a break. We'll continue. We welcome your letters. Panel@WAMC.org. Panel@WAMC.org. We'll return right after this. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning, talking about the Secretary of Defense, Pete Hegseth, and the current controversy regarding his tenure. We go to some listener letters and check in with Matt, who said, Senator Tammy Duckworth, a Democrat of Illinois, a combat veteran and member of the Armed Services Committee, was even more direct, saying Hegseth's tenure is endangering American troops. Quote, how many times does Pete Hegseth need to leak classified intelligence before Donald Trump and Republicans understand that he isn't only a blanking liar, he is a threat to our national security? She said in a statement, every day he stays in his job is another day our troops' lives are endangered by his singular stupidity. That from Tammy Duckworth via listener Matt. Then, let's see, we have another letter here, this one from Tom. Hegseth aside, there are reasons the Secretary of Defense and other cabinet members would be at the Easter egg roll. The Easter egg roll is attended by families of administration staffers and the public who win lotteried spots, but there is usually a tranche of visitors of special audience, often military families, sometimes specifically of wounded vets or other specific segments, etc., who get to come for a specified window of time in a specified separate area. So that taking that very seriously as we were trying to figure out.
What will not stand for egg roll misinformation.
I apologize for my snarky remark about what he was doing there, but it just seems that it was an awfully weird juxtaposition of the big, tall Easter bunny and Hegseth, you know, screaming at the camera and blaming the news media.
And while the letter writer is probably, undoubtedly correct, there still is the question as to if you have someone who is in battle, do you get them out there or do you say, hey, Pete, why don't you go down to the diner this morning and we'll meet back at noon? Kate says, in addition to Hegseth's security failures and personal insecurities, why do you need to bring your wife to sensitive meetings or text her and your brother? Do your job. Be a big boy. He claims he's returning the Pentagon to the war fighters. His job is to be the civilian leader of the military, below the president. That is very much on purpose and defined by law, and he is very much proudly claiming to undermine the law. In an accountable and constitutional world, he would be forced to resign or impeached himself. That from Kate. Then, let's see. I thought I had one more.
Well, there does seem to be at least a slight erosion of his support in the Senate. You know, is that Senator Bacon in before the break you mentioned. And, you know, you just need a few more, and it could put pressure on the White House to pick somebody who's more. I mean, they're probably looking already. I mean, even if they don't fire Hegseth right out right away, they probably need to have a backup. Have to have somebody ready should Hegseth just, you know, break down and have to quit, you know. And it seems like he's under an awful lot of pressure that that kind of thing happens.
D makes this point. Not one of Trump's cabinet picks deserves to be there, with the possible exception of Marco Rubio. The head of Homeland Security was just purse snatch, for goodness sakes. The only $3,000.
Yeah, she carries $3,000.
Her passport?
Yeah, and $3,000 in her passport. Yeah.
Not so secure at Homeland
Security.
And
by the way, and had security herself, which is telling,
right.
I think.
Yeah, that's the.
The only prerequisite was, do you believe Trump won the 2020 election and the Congress fell in line and supported it? When will people wake up? And that is the question from Dee this morning. All right. Anyone else on any of that? Then let us move forward and go to our next item. We welcome your letters, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. The Harvard University is suing the Trump administration. This also is a back and forth story that is continuing to make news. And it really is, again, much like the Hegseth story, where there was a lot of back and forth and a lot of, I think, confusion. This story is not does not lack for that either. Harvard is suing the Trump administration over threats to cut funding. It is the wealthiest university in the world, and is suing the Trump administration, and they're fighting back against the threats to slash billions of dollars from the school's research funding as part of a crusade against the nation's top colleges. The lawsuit signaled a major escalation of the ongoing fight between higher education and President Trump.
Okay.
Think of going through puberty. I can't wait for the growth spurt. The administration has cast its campaign as a fight against anti-Semitism, but also has targeted programs and teaching related to racial diversity and gender issues. Earlier this month, it sent Harvard a list of demands that included auditing professors for plagiarism, reporting to the federal government and any international students accused of misconduct, and appointing an outside overseer to make sure that academic departments were viewpoint diverse. Ellen Garber, Harvard's president, accused the government in a statement on Monday of trying to wield unprecedented and improper control. Dr. Garber said the consequences of the government's actions would be severe and long-lasting. The Trump administration has claimed that Harvard and other schools have allowed anti-Semitic language and harassment to remain unchecked on their campuses. Monday's lawsuit noted that the government has cited the university's response to anti-Semitism as justification for its unlawful action. So going back and forth again, Harvard suing. Also, there was the story over the weekend that apparently the letter sent to Harvard came. Not that they're backing away from what the letter said, but that it was sent earlier than they had anticipated. And then they accused Harvard of reacting negatively, to which Harvard said, I don't know what you want us to do. We got a letter on letterhead signed by the three people we were talking to, telling us that you were going to do all the things that you said we could work out. And so we reacted. And instead of then trying to figure out, oh, we made a mistake and let's go back to the drawing board, that was when the president said, we're going to take away the $2 billion. Now the Wall Street Journal is reporting they're looking to take out another $1 billion in funding, and all of this leading to yesterday's action for Harvard University to file suit. against the Trump administration.
I'm going to speak on behalf of my dad. And I know that the first thing he's going to say is the universities are bloated anyway. They shouldn't be getting federal funding. You know, why are we giving $1 billion to Harvard, which is very clearly anti-Semitic? And as a Jewish man, I've suffered in this country. You can see how much I've suffered by my high position in society. I would counteract his points by saying...
I just want to point out your dad, Rich Honan, who is on our program and a very successful tech attorney here in town.
Yes. Yeah. His name precedes me. but I would say this is money that's going towards research, as was discussed. This is going towards research funded by the National Institute of Health. This is going towards biotech. This is going towards important stuff. Politics aside, we need research universities to do research, and that's something that's becoming slowly defunded. We've seen that with MEPs that are getting their federal funding taken away. Also, the point is not the suing. It's the fact that hidden in there, it's like, oh, by the way, you need to report on international students to the federal government.
Right.
That's horrifying. And I think that you get like kind of mixed up in the weeds, like, oh, Harvard's suing them. Oh, there's this, you know, this letter. They said this. They said that. And like, actually, this is really scary. They're asking an academic institution to report on, what is it like? What do they call it in 1984? Like double think, double speak, like things that you're not allowed to say. I mean, it's comically evil. It would be comical if it wasn't so evil, I guess I should say.
We'll pause there. We'll continue this conversation on Harvard and other issues when we return. We welcome your letters, panel@wamc.org. We will continue after this break and news with Ray Graff. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion. Emily Honan is here, grants analyst based in Albany, New York. The Empire Report's J.P. Miller is here, and Mike Spain, former Times Union associate editor. Thank you all for being with us this morning. We welcome you to join us, panel@wamc.org, panel@wamc.org. We are talking about Harvard University and the fact that Harvard University's latest step in its war with the White House is to sue them. And they are suing the Trump administration, this after a back and forth that has been going on for several weeks. And we heard from Emily just before the break. And Mike, we'll go to you.
Yeah, it's hard to for a lot of people to get full-throated behind Harvard, because Harvard has forever been an elite institution, and it's lofty, and it has a ton of money, and it's hard to be sympathetic. But they clearly are taking a courageous path where Columbia basically buckled. Alan Garber, who himself is Jewish, and talks about the real existential threat of anti-Semitism and recognizes that, says, in this case, the Trump administration is using that as a cudgel, as an excuse to go in and want to have say over faculty member and diversity higher, you know, for DEI to be banned, but they want diversity of thought among the faculty members that are hired, and they want to be able to oversee that. And they want, you know, as Emily was pointing out, they want a list of students who've, foreign students who've been disciplined in some way. So if you got drunk on a Saturday night and made a lot of noise and you got a, you know, some demerits in your dorm, now you can be sent back home for that, and your student visa can be removed. And it goes into anybody they get out of the country goes into that count, you know, and the number that they can say, we got rid of these bad, bad people, you know, and that's ridiculous. But in any event, people are pretty much watching this battle. Harvard will be well defended, I'm sure, on this, and they're ready to fight this all the way to the Supreme Court. It'll be very interesting. Their primary argument is it's a violation of their First Amendment rights.
Yeah, I think it is it's an easy battle for Trump to pick. This is a, you know, for him, very good politically. you know, he certainly doesn't do well with Ivy League educated voters, right? And to offend them is not something that he's concerned about. And he having this battle with you know, the Ivies is something that I think is going to benefit him politically. I think it's a surprise to a lot of Americans that hundreds of millions and billions of dollars is given to private institutions that have, you know, tens of billions, if not hundreds of billions, in their endowments, and they charge, you know, $90,000 a year to their students for room and board, and that those students,
tuition room and board. Let's clarify.
And that those students, you know, our generation, my generation, Emily, and your generation, is certainly affected significantly by the student debt crisis, and there is a generation of Americans that can't afford a first home because of paying these exorbitant tuition and room and board costs at places like Harvard. What on the legal front, I had read something about Bob Jones University lost their tax-exempt status years ago in a case that went all the way up to the Supreme Court because of their racially discriminatory policies at Bob Jones University. And I think that that's something that the Trump administration is going to try to go at, it, which is the tax-exempt status of Harvard University. And so this is, I think, a smart political battle for Trump. I think it's a battle that he, even if he loses legally, it's one that he wins politically.
Also, what's going to happen if he loses legally? That was the whole thing I was wondering. It's like, oh, they're going to sue Trump. Do what? Give him a little sticker that says you can't do this. He's just not, you know, adhering to a 9-0 decision. Sorry.
No, I was going to say. I mean, I do think I understand what everyone is saying, and it's hard to extricate. For me to explain it and to be knowledgeable in discussing this topic of extricating what you just described, JP, of a quote unquote elite institution that is doing what it's doing and the research that they are providing for the greater good of the world. And taking of what is being lost in that research, so you have the best and the brightest who are working on these issues that are of great importance that suddenly are losing their funding to the tune of $2, perhaps $3 billion, and again, as I said, it's hard to extricate to say, okay, well, how much of this, you know, if not them, who, where does this go? What else happens to the research? Where does it go? Is another institution even
qualified
yeah. and capable of providing that service that is being offered by Harvard University?
I mean, this is a system that has grown over the years, and it has existed for some time, where top universities get major government grants to attract the top faculty from across the world and study things like Alzheimer's disease, the spread of infectious disease, Parkinson's. They at Harvard study the way that soldiers are injured at war and the best way to prevent that. I mean, they do extraordinarily valuable research that gets applied and turned into practical, you know, medical advice, practical treatment for disease, practical methods to prevent the spread of disease, and there's other science that is also explored. And that is the way it is. You just can't pull the plug on it overnight and say, well, they don't deserve it because they're a big elite school that hasn't properly fought anti-Semitism, when they have demonstrated that they're willing to do what the administration is pushing on that regard.
I think that still, you know, going back to what JP said, it is a very easy battle to pick. You can spin it very well. Trump can spin it very well. Look at this elite institution taking these billions of taxpayer dollars, not fighting anti-Semitism, and then they want to get mad at me for you know, trampling on their First Amendment rights, because not a lot of people are going to look at it in the way that it's taking away research funding for having DEI policies, which is what it is.
Anybody else? All right. We welcome your letters. Panel at WAMC.org. Panel at WAMC.org. Isla says doublespeak is what officials and certain media figureheads say through thought crime is what thought we crime. Are guilty of in critically evaluating what we hear them say, understand that they do, and consider doing to oppose it. Please put me down as a proud member of that crime syndicate. Isla, we have done it for you. Consider yourself a proud member. All right, let's move on to other stories. And again, we welcome your letters. Emily sent me an interesting article last night that I thought we could talk about. This is from Vox and is really fascinating in its about, and it was published over the weekend, the nightmarish problem with trying to make Trump obey court orders. How can you punish Trump officials for violating the law when federal law enforcement is controlled by Trump? And this goes to so many of the stories that we're talking about, so many of the things that we've been talking about over the course of this morning and this week and, oh, just about every day on this program. Top officials within the Justice Department, the State Department, and possibly even the White House may be barreling toward a criminal conviction for contempt of court. It is far from clear, however, whether anything will happen to them, even if they are convicted. On Wednesday, Chief Judge James Boasberg determined that he has probable cause to conclude that the Trump administration officials who defied one of his orders, which required the administration to halt deportations under an illegal order invoking a wartime statute, should be held in contempt of court. Contempt is a process used to punish people who violate court orders, sometimes with imprisonment. Boasberg's order concludes that unless the government provides due process to the people who were deported by allowing them to challenge their deportation in federal court, he will identify the officials responsible for this defiance and subject them to a criminal trial. The immediate thing I'm wondering is, like, well, how do you do that? But okay. Boasberg's original order halting these deportations was eventually vacated by five of the Supreme Court's Republican justices who argue that the plaintiffs in that case brought their lawsuit in the wrong court. But as the Supreme Court said in the U.S. versus United Mine Workers, 1947, a defendant may be punished for criminal contempt for disobedience of an order later set aside on appeal.
Well, yeah, I mean, I guess that's really just the big problem. Once again, I'm going to channel my dad because he likes to bring up the fact that Biden also ignored a court order when he was, I think, freezing student loan debt. And to that, I like to say, I'm like, Dad, it's not even on the same planet. I mean, student liaison, yes, it sets a terrible precedent, and it's something that we probably should have paid more attention to, but no one really wanted to because it's, you know, for the vast majority of people, it's not really seen as a bad thing. But this is, now it's become something worse. Now it's become the president can deport people with no due process to El Salvador, which is for a year of my life, I worked in immigration law, and my entire job was to look up human rights violations in El Salvador and make the arguments as to why people coming from there deserved asylum. And after coming out of that job, I pretty much came to the conclusion anybody coming from El Salvador for any reason at all deserves asylum. That's how horrible the things I read were. And I don't want to blame it on the country either. Because as we all know, MS-13 was created by 1980s deportations by the U.S. to El Salvador. That a little bit of a tangent there, but just that's the full horror of what we're working with.
Well, again, in this idea, we were just talking about it with Harvard, the Harvard story. If you find them in contempt or you find them if Harvard wins its lawsuit, who pays? I mean, what happens?
Yeah.
What are the ramifications?
Nothing.
Right. Well, in this particular case, if Trump officials are found to be in contempt of court, ordinarily, this story points out that it's the U.S. Marshals that would, you know, basically enforce the rule. But they're part of the Justice Department, which is part of the administration. And if they basically, Trump could just, if somebody was found guilty of contempt, tomorrow we could just issue a pardon for that person and they'd be untouchable, essentially. So the Constitution does have a remedy for that, at least technically, and that's called impeachment. But in order for that to happen, you need a conviction after impeachment. I mean, first you have to have impeachment in the House of Representatives, and then you have to have a trial in the Senate, and two-thirds of the Senate have to vote, basically to convict the president of the charges contained in the articles of impeachment. But Congress has been AWOL on that regard. They're not participating in what the founders envisioned as these controls and these checks and balances to keep the government on track.
What I would say, Mike, is on the impeachment thing, depending on Trump's what he does with the economy in another year and a half, he could lose a significant number of U.S. Senate seats that put him in danger of potentially getting convicted in the Senate. I'm not saying it's a home run, but it's not out of the realm of possibility if he is successful in tanking the economy as he has been in the first 3 months, and he continues that, and a bad economy, nothing can.
It's the economy,
hurt
stupid.
Nothing can hurt a presidency like a bad economy, and so that's not out of the realm of possibility. I also look at him defying the Supreme Court as a much scarier and unsettling proposition of the Trump administration not listening to one of 1,700 federal judges. I think that, as you mentioned, Emily, you know, I think that White Houses in the past have gone against federal judges and said, let's bring it to the Supreme Court and see how it shakes out. And you saw a lot of advocacy on that from both Democrats and Republicans in terms of allowing any one of 1,700 federal judges to stop in the tracks the White House that was just elected 3 months ago.
Yeah. Well, understand, though, that the presidents, and even in this case involving Abrego Garcia, the El Salvadorian sent back to El Salvador to the prison there, in these cases, they're trying to come through a loophole. I mean, Biden was using loopholes to get around the student loan thing. You know, whether or not that would hold up in court, that would be tested. And even the Supreme Court ruling that sent the case back that backed the lower court judge did advise the judge that a judge can't, require the U.S. government to negotiate certain things with foreign countries. So don't go that way. Just stick to the rules here. And they're going through that narrow little window to try to push it down. So in a technical sense, they haven't yet fully been, they haven't defied the federal court ruling yet, because it can still go through the courts and go back to the Supreme Court at this point.
And now we see sort of it's difficult to know what to make of it, but the president being critical of the Supreme Court and speaking out on Truth Social of the Supreme Court. And while that has not been the case recently, up until now, it is interesting to see what, if any, effect. It shouldn't have an effect, obviously, but it may. I don't know.
And that is, people talk about people have been talking about constitutional crisis with Trump ever since he came on the scene. But that is what I view is once he goes over that barrier, and I don't think it's a question for many of us that he would go over that line, which is openly defying the Supreme Court, that would be, and a lot of people would say he's already there. But that would be, in my view, a new crisis situation when he openly goes against the Supreme Court.
All right. I want to just take the moments before we go to a break to remind you that we have a cool event coming up a week from tomorrow, which is April 30th. And we're going to be bringing this show to Oneonta. And why? Because we want to bring this show to Oneonta. How cool is it to go to Oneonta? So that's exactly what we're going to be doing. WAMC On the Road, we have been talking about our On the Road project. And this indeed, a Kerouac aside, will be a very interesting, I think, journey to Oneonta to do this show and to invite a very interesting group of people to talk about interesting things. So let me explain this to you. What we are going to be doing is on Wednesday, April 30th, that is the 100th day of the second administration of Donald J. Trump. And while we will be talking about this, it's going to be that's sort of the loose framework of what we're going to be doing. But we're going to be visiting the Hartwick Institute of Public Service. Laurel Elder, who is a regular on our program, professor, and is chair of the of political science at Hartwick and a co-director of this Hartwick Institute of Public Service, will be joined by her two colleagues, co-directors, co-founders, Zachary McKinney and Matthew Chick. Plus, we will have six students who will join us for this particular program to talk about things like democracy and government and civics and, oh yes, where we are in this current state, the view from young people. We welcome you to join us if you would like to be a part of the program. We would love to have you come. We have tickets available to you. All you got to do is go to WAMC.org, WAMC.org, and you will see that there is a link there, and it'll bring you right to WAMC-on-the-road, which is where you can also write it out. But just go to the link, click it, and you can find out how to get tickets for our Live in Oneonta program. The tickets are, quantities are extremely limited because we're offering them to the Hartwick community as well. And so for those within our audience, we have a very few tickets available, and we'd love for you to be a part of this really interesting program. $50 per ticket. You can go to WAMC.org and click on the link and find out more information about those tickets. We will be having a great time. The show is going to go from 9 to 10:30. We'll open doors at 8:30. And we're going to be at Shinneman Chapel House, which is on Hartwick Drive in Oneonta. If you've ever been to the campus of Hartwick, it's a beautiful, beautiful campus. Shinneman Hall is absolutely gorgeous, and I think it'll be a great place for us to meet. They do these just super events there that this institute does. They recently had the Lieutenant Governor, Antonio Delgado. He still is Lieutenant Governor, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
reasonable question.
Yeah, I just wanted to check. I know there was an announcement. I didn't know how far it went, but yes. And then the students who are involved in the community becomes involved, and that's what we'll be doing at Hartwick when we visit there 1 week from tomorrow, April 30th, 8:30 to 10:30, and you can find out more at wamc.org. Gosh, we'd love to have you be a part of the program and join us. It'll be great fun, but also very interesting as a way of talking about 100 days of the Trump administration and other very important democratic issues. WAMC.org. We'll take a quick break and come back and finish up on the other side. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. A few more minutes with this terrific group, and we welcome you, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. A couple letters before we move on to another topic. Sarah writes to us and says, only judicial warrants are legal for detaining people. Administrative warrants are illegal for detaining. If everyone knows, maybe detaining people will stop. We hope, right? And then we go to Jeffrey. I wanted to respond to a point made about Biden ignoring court orders on student loans. I keep hearing conservatives try to claim he ignored the courts. No, he didn't. SCOTUS ruled he couldn't give blanket $10,000 and $20,000 forgiveness on all student loans, and it did not happen. That didn't prevent him from attempting other, more narrow forms of loan relief, some of which had injunctions placed on them, which were honored by his administration, which I think is the point you were making earlier, Emily. Jeffrey, thank you very much for the note. All right, we move on, and as I said, as we move to our conclusion here, I want to get to one, perhaps two more stories. This from the Washington Post. There is only one person mentioned by name in President Trump's executive order titled Restoring Truth and Sanity to American History. That's the order that seeks to restore the Smithsonian Institution to its rightful place as a symbol of inspiration and American greatness, a quote, through removing mentions of historical racism, and the name in the order will probably not ring a bell. It is Lindsey Halligan, Esquire. Halligan, according to the order, will consult with Vice President J.D. Vance to, quote, remove proper ideology from Smithsonian properties. The first question is, what is improper ideology exactly? The second, who is Lindsey Halligan, Esquire? So I would say that she, talking to the Washington Post, said, I would say that improper ideology would be weaponizing history. We don't need to overemphasize the negative to teach people that certain aspects of our nation's history may have been bad. That overemphasis just makes us grow further and further apart. As for the second question, Halligan, who's 35 years old, is a Trump attorney who seems to have tasked herself as a sort of commissioner or expurgator, according to critics, of a premier cultural institution. After moving to D.C. just before the inauguration to continue working for Trump as a special assistant and senior associate staff secretary, Halligan visited local cultural institutions, including the Smithsonian Museums of Natural History, American History, and American Art. She didn't like what she saw. Some exhibits, in her view, did not reflect the America that she knows and that she loves. So, Halligan says, I talked to the president about it, and he suggested an executive order and gave me his blessing, and here we are. Yes, here we are. A former Fox News host is leading the Pentagon. A vaccine skeptic is running the Department of Health and Human Services. A former professional wrestling executive is head of the Department of Education. And Lindsey Halligan could turn a major cultural institution upside down. Halligan attended Regis University, a Jesuit university in Denver, where she studied politics and broadcast journalism. She competed in the Miss Colorado USA pageant, making the semifinals in 2009 and earning third runner-up in 2010. Sports and pageants taught me confidence, discipline, and how to handle pressure on the court, on the field, on the stage, in the courtroom, and now in the White House, Halligan says in the interview with the Washington Post. She studied law at the University of Miami. So now, with looking at this as to where what indeed will change at the Smithsonian Museums, it is this look at history. And I don't know if you know this or not, but as pointed out in this article in the Washington Post, Donald Trump is not much of a museum goer.
That's shocking to me. Oh my!
February 21st, 2017, he visited the National Museum of African American History and Culture. In his memoir, Smithsonian Secretary Lonnie Bunch, then the museum's director, recalled that before the president arrived, aides told Bunch that Trump was in a foul mood and that he did not want to see anything, quote, difficult. Nevertheless, Bunch began the private tour in a gallery about the transatlantic slave trade. It was not my job to make the rough edges of history smooth, even for the president, Bunch wrote. In the executive order that features Halligan, Three D.C. museums are specifically mentioned. First, a reference to an infographic about white culture on the African-American Museum's website that was removed in 2020 after Donald Trump criticized it in a social media post. The second in the Smithsonian American Women's History Museum, whose opening is years down the road, yet the order claims it will celebrate male athletes participating in women's sports. False, according to the Smithsonian spokeswoman Linda St. Thomas. The third museum is the Smithsonian American Art Museum, which Halligan visited this winter as she was getting to know D.C. An exhibit titled The Shape of Power, Stories in Race and American Sculpture is specified in the executive order as an example of improper ideology. Walking through that exhibition, it's easy to see how it could become a flashpoint for the Trump administration. Text accompanying the artworks, which explore the way different races of people sculpt themselves and others, explains that race is not biological and that sculpture, quote, has been a powerful tool in promoting scientific racism, in that it could be used to perpetuate harmful stereotypes about bodies of color. Finally, as we wrap up before I send this over to the panelists, during her visits to the museums, Halligan says she saw exhibits that have to do with either another country's history entirely or art and sculpture that describes on the placards next to it that America and sculpture are inherently racist, though she did not offer specific details. That, again, from the Washington Post.
That's always a wacky quote to me. It's like, oh my gosh, they're saying that America is racist? We were built on the triangle trade. Our Constitution has language about slaves in it. What are you talking about? Well, I suppose I can't really expect much from someone who went to a private Catholic school and then a private Jesuit college. I'm sure her worldview is very vast.
Yes, although I think... certainly people who have gone to such institutions have come out perhaps not thinking that those things don't exist. But it is an odd, someone so young to be put in such a position of basically doing what this administration, Mike, is doing in on many, many fronts, on its websites and in the Park Service and so forth, of taking away the things that are rough or
unpleasant.
Unpleasant,
yeah,
yes.
I mean, nobody wants to celebrate things that aren't something we're proud of, you know. And there's a lot of things in our history that we'd just rather forget about, and why should we talk about it now? I mean, this is an approach. I mean, and essentially she is, Halligan is one of the culture filters that are now going to have enormous sway and enormous power to do exactly that, is to filter out all the unpleasantries. Do you remember there was the 1609 report from the New York
Yes.
Times back when Trump was in the first administration of Trump 0.10? Right at the very end, after he had lost the election to Joe Biden, right around that time, I think it was like right after the election was lost, his staff was throwing together in a matter of weeks a counter plan called the 1776 report. You know, it was like the same thing. And it was intended to just talk about all the good stuff. And it didn't get into any of that bad stuff back in the Revolution. I mean, you know, yeah, they had slavery and that was in the Constitution and all that. But, you know, it wasn't that pleasant. So we should celebrate the goodness and just forget about the bad. And you know, as I think we all know, when we ignore the mistakes of the past, we're bound to make them again, you know. And that really is pretty obvious.
Go ahead, JP.
I found it interesting how this decision was made, which was she got a meeting with the president, and this all sounded like news to him. And he goes, "Well, how about an executive order? We'll just have you do it. No problem." Also, this also reminds me of the Kennedy Center, how he renamed the board of the Kennedy Center, and how there seems to be a new this. I don't really remember this as much in the first Trump presidency, which is a renewed focus on cultural institutions and, really trying to, I don't really understand what they're trying to do in terms of eliminating the history. You know, if the Smithsonian has exhibits or content that they don't like, then you don't go and visit that, you know, exhibit, or you don't learn about that topic. But to eliminate it seems crazy to me. What content you produce is really in the shows its success by how many people go and look at it and start talking about it and reading about it and writing about it, whether it is uncomfortable topics or it's more the glory of what made America great.
Well, I mean, besides what is popular with people and how many people show up, there is also the truth and what happened, and an unvarnished look at our history. And if that is done in a way that is fair and honest, then which I would argue in this case the Smithsonian has done for generations, it is now being, for want of a better term, whitewashed, although probably a very accurate term.
Yeah.
Whitewashed to the point where all of those references are being taken away, and thereby taking away for generations coming into the museum that understanding of our history and how we got to where we are. And without going on a soapbox, which I try not to do ever on this program, but meanwhile, we're deporting people. And we're due process, and we're sending immigrants and migrants back, and we are closing down opportunities for anyone with black or brown skin, and how will that then be written about in the future?
It won't be.
Yeah.
Well, in the future we will look at this period, and I wonder how the future will define this period, but I think it's going to be it'll be dark days in our history, and it'll be it'll be like looking back at some of the racism in the 1930s and some of the pre-civil rights discrimination that was going on before the Civil Rights Act, and you know, it has to be talked about, and I think it'll be talked about honestly, and I think this is one of those dark stories that will be part of the Smithsonian down the road, I hope.
Well, and you only look, and final thought on this, but you only look at these three museums that are being looked at right now, but then you think, well, what are they going to do at the Native American Museum?
Right.
What are they going to do at the African American Museum? What are they going to do at the Holocaust Museum? And that is obviously troubling in thinking about what that possibly could be. We are out of time. We'll end there. My thanks to everyone, Mike Spain, Emily Honan, J.P. Miller. You're all wonderful. I appreciate your time and your thoughts. We'll be back right after this.